This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A year ago, Floyd Landis emerged from the shadow of Lance Armstrong to win the greatest bicycle race in the world, the Tour de France. Along the way, he overcame both an excruciating injury and one disastrous day to stage what many described as the greatest comeback in the history of this great race. Then, just a couple of days after his triumphant ride down the Champs-Élysées, Landis found himself immersed in scandal and controversy that continues to this day. Floyd Landis insists that he won fair and square, and he challenges the laboratory that detected banned substances and the agencies that police his sport. He's written a book whose title states his case succinctly: Positively False. In a moment, he joins us to take your calls about the race of his life and his fight for his title, his career, and his reputation. Later in the program, the fashion of girl power. Robin Givon of the Washington Post joins us, and we'll talk with the man whose homemade video helped Springfield, Vermont win the honor of hosting the premiere of the Simpsons movie. But first, if you have questions for Floyd Landis, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Floyd Landis joins us from our bureau in Chicago, along with Lauren Mooney. He's the author of Positively False, The Real Story of How I Won the Tour de France. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And it's got to be difficult to be here in the United States on a book tour while the tour is underway in France.
Yeah, it's not my first choice, but I knew it was coming for a while. I expected this to take quite a bit of time, and so I'll be here doing my book tour and watching the tour on television. I'm certainly still a cycling fan, and I hope that the cycling fans in America still give the guys that are racing now the respect and support they deserve.
As I understand it, your appeal to an arbitration board, their decision is expected any day now.
We don't really have any reference or idea when the decision will be made. They have 10 days from the date of closing of the proceedings to make a decision, but they adjourned the proceedings, and we haven't heard from them since, so who knows?
Who knows? And even after they make their decision, there is one more final court of appeal. That would be in Switzerland, and I suspect whoever loses this round will appeal to Switzerland.
Well, I assume we will appeal it. I'll wait to see what the grounds are on which they convict me. I mean, from what the science demonstrated at the hearing, I can't imagine what they're going to say. And for the other side, the anti-doping agencies, I don't know what the purpose would be of appealing, but there is a possibility.
Mm-hmm. So this could drag on for months more.
Yes, which is part of my complaint about the way the system is set up. And part of a sport which has a large professional, it's a bigger professional sport than a lot of Olympic sports, which are governed by the World Anti-Doping Association.
Mm-hmm.
And most of those athletes participate in their sport for the love of the sport and the passion. And whether they win an Olympic gold medal or make it to the top of their sport, very few of them have any motivation of any kind other than just being passionate about the sport, and it's unfortunate that they would have to go through something like this, being completely unable to pay for the proceedings.
And you've spent $1 to $2 million is what you said in the book.
$2 million now so far.
And that's obviously an awful lot of money that is beyond the capacity of you're not a rich man either.
No, look, I didn't start out with $1 million, but I am fortunate enough to have won the tour and to still have quite a few fans and supporters, and so I've gone on a bit of a crusade looking for supporters, and I've been able to finance it through fans and people that understand that the system needs to be fixed so that the next person that goes through this who doesn't have the ability to get this amount of publicity can defend himself.
So far, these cases brought by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, they have invariably proved to be correct, or at least the verdict have always come down on their side. Do you understand when people are skeptical. It's not just that, but we all remember, and this has nothing to do with you individually, but Rafael Palmeiro, the baseball player, shaking his finger at a congressional hearing saying, "I never used performance-enhancing drugs," and then testing positive a couple of months later. It has been so many people involved in sports who, when they're caught, deny it, and then it's proved that they did it.
Well, it was proved that I didn't do it a few months ago. It never did test positive. The lab never measured testosterone in the first place. They just they applied a number which was, they have to identify the substance, first of all. Testosterone doesn't come with a label on it out of the urine. They have to figure out what it is, and then they have to measure it. And when they measure something that's not testosterone and give it a number, it's meaningless. And so we can talk about people that tested positive and argued later, but I never tested positive.
Here's an email question from John in Kalamazoo, Michigan. As an avid cyclist and a huge but seriously wavering fan of professional cycling, I have to ask, why, when you were first asked if you doped when it seemed non-negative, did you respond, "I'll say no," knowing that no matter what I say won't matter, then "I'll say no" sounds evasive? Also, did you also say that you were not in a doping program? Isn't that another artful way of avoiding directly answering the question? Personally, he adds, I cannot imagine winning the tour in today's world without some assistance.
Well, he doesn't sound like a guy that I should even bother to debate it with, but to clear up the things that I said in the beginning of this, I was told that I'd tested positive. With no more information than that, I was expected to explain to the world what it was that I had done. Then I had to wait about 2 months to get any information at all from the laboratory and from the anti-doping agencies. And so in that time, rather than run and hide, which would have looked even more guilty, I was willing to give interviews, and often things were taken completely out of context and turned around because, well, I wasn't given the benefit of the doubt. And yet, I guess it never occurred to the journalists and to the people watching that I certainly am not a testosterone testing expert, and I had no idea what could possibly have caused it, because I didn't even have the results.
You confessed in your book that as a result of your confusion, you said some stuff that you regret, the stuff about drinking a beer and some Jack Daniels the night before and the way that was misinterpreted.
Well, I never said anything that was untrue. I didn't realize at the time that everything I said was going to be taken as me trying to explain a positive test. Again, there never was a positive test. I didn't know that at the time. I couldn't have known that at the time. I was completely caught off guard and asked to explain what I had done. So I told everyone what I did the day before. I had some beer. What would you do after a day like I had?
That was after that one disastrous day, yes.
Yeah.
I might not have stopped at one.
And, and anyway, it was taken as Floyd trying to explain a positive test by saying he drank alcohol, and that was never meant to come out across that way.
Mm-hmm. There is also, and again, this is not related to your specific case, but the sport of cycling has been rife with accusations, and even since the last Tour de France, the 1996, I think, winner came out and said that he used assistance when he won the race.
Yeah, Bjarne Riis, who won the race in 96, I think you're right,
yeah.
Admitted to having taken EPO. That was before there was a test for EPO. Since then, I don't remember exactly when they started using it.
Mm-hmm.
Since I've been a professional, it's always existed. But anyway, that's not the point. The point is there's always going to be people in every sport who try to cheat. And the anti-doping authorities, assuming they're ethical and athletes trust them, need to continue to try to enforce it, but do so in a way that doesn't overwhelm everything that's good about the sport. And right now, that's the only subject in cycling, because the anti-doping agencies have found a way to take all the attention away from the beauty of it.
Fairly or not, as a result of all the accusations and these revelations, a lot of people assume that everybody does it.
Well, in that case, then the anti-doping agencies should just stop, because they don't catch very many people. And if everyone does it, it seems like a waste of time.
Let's see if we can get some callers in on this conversation. Our guest, of course, is Floyd Landis, the victor in last year's Tour de France. And if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Andrew. Andrew is with us from, is it Tahlequah in Oklahoma? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
It's Tahlequah.
Tahlequah.
Nobody gets it right the first time.
Well, I probably don't get it right the third time, but go ahead.
I just wanted to tell Lance that what a big fan I am and how much I enjoyed watching your comeback stage. Always know there's at least one guy in eastern Oklahoma screaming at his television when you're on your bike. So I just want you to know in my heart of hearts, I believe you, and I hope you're shown innocent. But even no matter what the verdict is, I hope you continue to pursue cycling and be involved in cycling no matter what.
Andrew, thank you. I appreciate that. And I hope that every other cycling fan out there, even though they may be a little disappointed with the focus on doping and drugs at the moment, I hope they don't forget what they enjoy about the sport and hope they go ride their bikes and watch the tour because those guys deserve respect.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, sir.
The rest of the show on the air.
Andrew, thanks very much for the call. Let's see if we can go now to Ron, and Ron's calling us from Sacramento.
Hi there.
Hi. Turn down your radio, Ron.
Okay, yes, sir. Thank you.
Go ahead.
My question is to Mr. Landis. What do you think about doping in general, or that is to say, using performance-enhancing product, is that something that should be allowed in cycling and in maybe other sports, or is that something you're just completely against?
If you're going to make rules and you have a list of things that are banned, then ultimately what you are accusing someone of doing when they use it is cheating. If you don't have rules, then you have a problem like you have in baseball where you have a philosophical debate as to whether someone cheated or not when there wasn't any rules. I don't know what the best way forward is for any given sport. There certainly needs to be controls in place to prevent people from doing something that's unhealthy or hurting themselves or setting a bad example for kids who want to get into the sport. So it certainly isn't something that needs to be ignored. However, it needs to be enforced by an agency which is also held to the same ethical standards. And there needs to be respect from both sides. And right now we don't have that in cycling. Other sports deal with it in different ways. But I don't want to be the one to judge what should or shouldn't be allowed. It's just that once you establish a list of what should not be allowed, then you have to assume that if you use it, it's cheating.
Right. Ron, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're talking with Floyd Landis about his new book, Positively False, The Real Story of How I Won the Tour de France. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. We'll talk more about his sport and his faith and his future in a minute. You can also send us email, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Floyd Landis writes in his book about winning the Tour de France, "I stood on the podium with my baseball cap on backward and my sunglasses on my forehead. I stuck both fists in the air and smiled as the crowd screamed. If things had ended then, my story would be just another part of cycling legend, just another amazing sports feat that people doubted could be done." Of course, things did not end there, and in the book Positively False, Floyd Landis fights back against accusations that he used banned substances. You can read his description of that final sprint to the finish line in an excerpt that we've posted at our website, npr.org/talk. Floyd Landis is with us from our bureau in Chicago. If you have questions for him, give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And let's see if we can get Ryan on the line. And Ryan's with us from Royal Oak in Michigan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, I'm an attorney and an avid cyclist and former racer, and I have to say that as a civil litigator, watching the proceedings against you, Floyd, has been absolutely shocking at times and surprising the way it's been conducted, and all of my luck to you in the future. My question, though, comes more from an avid cyclist perspective. I'd like you to describe your or talk about your comeback performance in the Tour last year. In light of your training and preparation for it, I know you're a huge proponent of training with power. Perhaps you could describe that to listeners. And in that light, was your comeback performance really out of the ordinary for your capabilities, or was it a performance that you had done in training and was really nothing special?
And just
I'm sorry.
I'm just going to insert, Ryan, for those who didn't follow the race that closely last year, after that one disastrous day, Floyd Landis made up, 9 minutes on the rest of the crowd and the rest of the field and in one day, an astonishing performance, and I think that's what Ryan is referring to.
Yeah. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Ryan, thanks for the call.
Thanks, Ryan. I made up on second place on that stage, I think 5.5 minutes, something like that. And on the other guys, well, they were scattered behind the second place guy, so some more than that. But he asked about training with power meter, and what that refers to is we have a device now, which is the best way to monitor how much work or effort you're putting into your training or into a race. And it measures the power output in units or in watts. So you have a constant way of knowing whether something is above what you ordinarily do or below what you ordinarily do. And I use that in the tour every day. And so I know what I can do in training, and I know what I could do for the 3 hours that I was in front of the Peloton. And for that reason, it became very useful to know how to pace myself over that amount of time so that I didn't overdo it in the first part of the race. It certainly wasn't over and above what I would do on a hard training ride. I don't do rides like that every day, but mm-hmm. There are training rides that I do that are equal to that or sometimes harder depending on how tired I am. So it was something that was calculated, and what really happened in that stage was, first of all, I was one of the strongest guys in the race to begin with. The day before was the anomaly.
The bad day, yeah.
Exactly. The rest of the Peloton had written me off and decided that I had lost so much time that I was not a threat, and they were willing to let me go in the hopes that I would get caught later. They miscalculated, and it was a tactical mistake on their part, not so much a superhuman feat.
Let's see if we get another caller in. This is Tim. Tim with us from Ypsilanti in Michigan.
Hi. How you doing, guys?
Good.
I wanted to ask, Floyd, did you know that your lawyer was going to blackmail Greg LeMond about the whole testifying thing?
I don't think it was his lawyer, but his then-manager, isn't that right?
Yeah, he was helping manage things at the time, yeah.
And this was involving a testimony that Greg LeMond, the also former winner of the Tour de France, was going to give in the case, and a threat by your then-manager that he would expose Greg LeMond as having been the victim of child abuse if he testified.
That's how it was characterized by Mr. LeMond. I don't think that blackmail is the right word. And I don't know that it was even meant to be a threat. I didn't know it was going to take place. I knew afterwards that it had taken place. It turns out to be a bad joke is what it was. And for Greg's part, I don't know exactly what it was that he was doing at the hearing in the first place. I mean, I assume he came to testify about something I may or may not have said to him in a phone call that took place months before that. Certainly, I never admitted anything to him, and he never sat on the witness stand and said that I admitted anything to him. The sad part about that whole scene was that Greg LeMond should never have come to that hearing in the first place, and under cross-examination refused to answer a single question. If you want to come to a hearing and impugn somebody's character, then you can at least subject yourself to cross-examination. Then he left, and all it did really was detract from the facts of the case.
Yet, if that was a bad joke, as you say, certainly it was in horrible taste.
Oh, absolutely. I would never defend that. The whole scene, the whole scenario was something that I wish could have been prevented. But again, it never should have even gotten to the point where Greg was there.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree. You know, all the talk about whether or not, you know, you were doping and everything, it kind of distracted away from the, you know, to true cycling fans who are loyal to Greg LeMond. It was just like a shocker when that came out.
No, that was bad on all accounts, and I really wish it could have prevented it, but, well, there's nothing I could have done.
Tim, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here's an email from Patrick in Arizona. It's hard to think of another group of employees in the world that more urgently needs a strong international union than professional cyclists. I think the riders' safety and rights are being ignored or directly violated by the teams, by the UCI, which is the International Union of Cyclists, if I have that right, WADA, which is the World Anti-Doping Agency, and race organizers. Floyd, do you agree?
Absolutely. The sport, really, in my opinion, needs to disconnect itself from the Olympics altogether so that it can get away from the World Anti-Doping Agency and then ultimately away from all of the anti-doping agencies, including USADA, which is the
U.S. version,
which
of that.
Is where the case against whom the case took place 2 months ago. How we will get a union started, I don't know, but I think that would go a long way to getting the athletes some rights, because right now the anti-doping agencies don't enforce ethics upon themselves and yet expect the athletes to explain every mistake made by them and by the labs.
It's interesting. You describe in the book the arrival of people to take urine samples at various times in your home, and you wave away your rights to do that. And in fact, if you avoid them, that's a missed test, and you're in trouble. Yet some of them, you say, take on, well, my word, not yours, Gestapo-like tendencies.
Well, they generally the guys who come out, I tend not to be disrespectful or upset with them. They're doing their job, and I'm not opposed to out of competition random tests like that. However, they do seem to, from the top down in the anti-doping organizations, seem to assume that athletes who are good at what they do or good at their sports are guilty, and they're willing to do whatever they can do to find them guilty of a doping offense and convict them. And that goes down to every detail of what they do, including showing up at people's homes at odd times.
Now let's get Gord on the line. Gord is with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hey, Floyd, it's Gord, your old teammate.
Gord, how are you?
Not bad, since I know you're a really busy guy. We haven't talked for a few weeks, so, and ironically just happened to tune into NPR, and there you are. So I thought I'd bring up a couple points, if I may.
Go ahead.
I think what the general public, and I'm speaking as an ex-athlete, I retired at the end of last year, and being a clean athlete my entire career, we were always walking, I think, on eggshells, because what the public, I think, don't seem to understand is that they take the position that these testing labs and the testers in general are beyond reproach, and I don't think that's necessarily the case.
It certainly I hope that was demonstrated at the hearing. I don't know how much of the general public watched it, but I do know that the people that were there saw that while they may have questions about people that win races or people that are good at any sport, not just cycling, they shouldn't just assume any time an anti-doping agency claims somebody is guilty that they're guilty. They should expect to see, I mean, we're talking about science here, they should expect to see reliable results and repeatable results, and that right now that isn't something that an athlete is given.
Exactly the point I was trying to make. The other thing I wanted to talk about is, you know, we had a teammate back in 01, Nicholas Axelson. Do you remember him?
I do, yeah.
And now Nicholas, he got caught with EPO, and it was refreshing at the time, because we both know Nicholas really well, and it was kind of refreshing, because when he was caught, he just came out and said, yeah, you got me. This is what I needed to do to be competitive. What, he was like fifth in the Tour of Italy or something like that the year before, and we all thought at the time, all the guys on Mercury, that here's a guy, he got caught, and he said, yeah, you got me. You know, give me my penalty. I might come back and race, I might not, but yeah, I've got nothing to hide. You caught me red-handed, I admit it. And whatever, I mean, listen, I've been riding a long time, and it's always the topic of conversation with me. Everyone asks me, what do you think about Floyd? And the biggest thing that I always say is, listen, if Floyd, I think Floyd has the character like Nicholas, if he was indeed caught with what they say he got caught with, I think Floyd would be the first one to admit it. What do you think?
I appreciate that, Gord. That means a lot, man.
Gord,
well,
thanks.
Keep the faith, and I hope, when's everything coming out? Do you know?
Well, we don't have any idea. They have 10 days after the close of proceedings, but they've adjourned it, so it's
so they never
indefinite. But yeah. Hopefully before the Tour de Tucson, I'd like to come out there again.
Yeah, well, if you're ever in Tucson, of course, give me a holler.
Okay.
Thanks, Gord.
Thanks very much for the call. There is sometimes less than transparency on the part of a lot of riders, too. You, for example, had a hip injury, and of course, that was one of the many things you overcame. You revealed it, in fact, during the course of the Tour de France, publicly revealed it. But nevertheless, medical conditions were not always disclosed. You were at various times trying to hide an injury. Various riders have doctors with whom they consult in murky circumstances sometimes. Should there be more more transparency on the rider's part as well.
Well, to try to apply the argument that, for example, in my case, I didn't talk about a hip injury. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but in the United States, medical records and things like that are protected and for a reason. There's no reason to disclose a hip injury. A hip injury isn't cheating by any standard that I know of. So there have been people to try to connect the fact that I didn't tell the whole world I had a hip injury and tried to make the connection that I didn't tell the world that I was doping, when the two are not related in any way. So transparency, depending on what you're referring to, yes, is good. But when it comes to injuries like that or things that are irrelevant to someone's performance or even detrimental to someone's performance, doesn't serve any purpose for everyone to know about it. Mm.
Floyd Landis is our guest. His book is Positively False, The Real Story of How I Won the Tour de France. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get, this is Lou. Lou's on the line from Cleveland. Lou, are you there?
Hello, Floyd. You had a hip resurfacing versus a total hip replacement. I would wonder if you would comment on how that was for you, what your rehab's been like, and how you feel that will affect your future in cycling. Thanks, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, and again, just to fill in, Floyd Landis broke his hip in an accident and then had deterioration of that hip. And since you won the Tour de France, you've had hip replacement surgery, and I think that's what he's asking about.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I feel fortunate to have had a lot of good doctors around who did a lot of research for me. I know that other people who go through traumatic things like that, and I broke my the femoral neck on the right side back in 2003, and over a period of years developed avascular necrosis. And I know that it's stressful and it's tough to make decisions when you are in pain all the time. And so I was lucky to have some good, intelligent people to put a lot of work into it to figure out what the best solution was. And what I had done is called a Birmingham hip. It's a resurfacing procedure as opposed to a total hip replacement. It still replaces both bearing surfaces on the femoral side, on the acetabular side, but it removes less bone on the femoral neck, remains in place, so that in the event of a revision later, you can go to a total hip replacement without nearly the complications of a second total hip replacement. It certainly is the best option for active people, for younger people that need a hip replacement, because it does, well, certainly it should last a lifetime, but if it doesn't, it does leave the opportunity for a hip replacement. And so I know that it's difficult to get through all the information and all the options that are available, but anyone who is active or younger that needs a hip replacement should definitely look into it.
Hmm. Let's go to Liz. Liz with us from Muncie, Indiana.
Hi. I was at the tour last year and then at the signing in Chicago on Monday, and I thought of this question actually after the talk on Monday night.
Now, the book signing that Floyd had in Chicago, yes.
Yeah, the one in Wheaton. It doesn't seem like, I mean, obviously it doesn't seem like you've been able to really celebrate your win. So I was just wondering, you know, has any good come from winning the tour, and are there any good things that have happened this past year that the press hasn't covered while they've been covering all of the negatives?
Well, it's tough to get a perspective on what someone's life is really like when it's all you can see is what's written in the press. Obviously, my life has been pretty well consumed by dealing with these doping allegations in this case, but I certainly am not. I'm not trying to make it seem, and I hope it doesn't seem that my life is all that bad. There are people going through far worse things than I'm having to deal with. While it might be humiliating, I'm healthy. I have a new hip. I'm not in pain. There's people that are probably today have been told that they're only going to live for a week, and so I really don't feel like things are all that bad for me.
Hmm. That's good to hear.
Thanks, Liz.
Thanks.
And here's an email from Joe in Nevada. Depending on the outcome of your case, will you race again?
I will race regardless of the outcome. I think that, well, I'm confident that the outcome will be in our favor, and that I'll be racing back in the tour next year. In the event that I'm convicted of this, then I'll have to wait another year before I start racing. But I certainly don't wish to end my career on this note. I will do whatever I can to come back and win some races and end it with some better memories.
And the hip replacement should be no problem with that?
Physically and mechanically, my hip is better than it was since I broke it back in 2003. And that won't ever be a factor in whether or not I get back to the same level of racing.
Well, Floyd Landis, thanks very much for coming in. And I know this some of these questions aren't all that pleasant sometimes, but we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Floyd Landis's book is Positively False, The Real Story of How I Won the Tour de France, and he joined us today from our bureau in Chicago. Coming up, Robin Givhan sees Girl Power on a comeback. We'll ask her about it. Plus, the real-life Homer Simpson who helped bring the premiere of the new Simpsons movie to Vermont. Stick around. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.